Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Walker. Mr. Brinson.
May it please the court. Raymond Walker was convicted of a conspiracy to deliver cocaine. It's alleged that he delivered cocaine to Rose McCray and persons known and unknown to the grand jury in an amount in excess of 50 grams of base cocaine. He was sentenced to life in prison. He moved to dismiss the indictment, count one, prior to trial because it was open-ended. It had no beginning date. The language of the indictment said that it was.
But of course, in the overt acts section, it does say from approximately June 04. And so my question on this is, what difference did it make that, you know, how was he prejudiced by the way that first count was construed?
Well,
but particularly when it's in the overt act, so he had notice.
You're saying that because he had no notice of when the indictment began, he couldn't prepare a defense, reaching back into the mists of time. If you're saying, well, in fact, that the evidence only went to June.
Well, it said.
But in fact, Your Honor, they introduced evidence going back to May.
Right. 1 month difference. And the overt act language is approximately June. So, I mean, May could certainly be in. I'm just trying to figure out what's the prejudice. Can you tell me what difference it made? You know, that the fact that that 1 month difference, how did that affect his ability to defend himself?
Well, because he has to prepare a defense in advance of trial, and he doesn't know exactly what the evidence is going to be until you get to trial.
Well, weren't those tapes turned over, the tapes that related to the earlier?
They were. And very shortly before the trial, the government filed a motion indicating that they were going to use them. So, yes, I did know about them. I didn't know they were going to use them until right before the trial. But I think you have a constitutional right to know the period of time that the indictment is said to begin.
And once you got those tapes and you found out the government was going to use them, did you ask for additional time? I know you made motions to try to keep the tapes out, but... Did you ask for additional time to prepare? Okay.
Well, if the indictment had charged that this conspiracy was starting sometime on or about September of 02, then move it back 2 years, would that have helped? As long as it's within the statute of limitations.
It would have made it comport with the Constitution, which requires that there be a begin date that so that you can prepare a defense and you can know what's jeopardy? What's
see, the problem is if an indictment would have been okay if it would have expanded this term significantly.
Yes, sir.
It's hard to find, as Judge Williams has pointed out, prejudice in narrowing that permissible time period of.
Well, the Constitution is dependent upon a finding of prejudice, and I don't think it is. I think the Fifth Amendment says you have a right to, or the Sixth Amendment says you have a right to know the charges against you in a conspiracy, a begin date and an end date.
Well, the in most in crimes that are charging a specific event, a robbery of a bank on a certain day, then it's important to know because you have to have an alibi. If you have an alibi defense, you want to know what date you're alleged to have done the criminal act, but in a conspiracy, that's pretty fluid.
Very fluid. And in fact, as the government learned more about its case, it expanded the reach of its evidence as the investigation went on. But I would like to move on to another point. I'll spend all my time on that if I could. The wiretaps are obviously very important in this case, and I think they're the thing that got him convicted. Rose McCray was a weak witness. The wiretaps were very strong. Question: how were they going to be introduced into evidence? First of all, the government tried to say he was part of the conspiracy. Judge found that no, he's not part of the conspiracy. These tapes only evidenced by Sal that he's not a co-conspirator. So then they became hearsay. But they were admitted to show Mr. Walker's part of the conversation. Those were admissions. And Mr. Cabell's parts were admissible because they put that in the context. The judge gave a limiting instruction to that effect. Case law is that that's okay in the Seventh Circuit. But the problem is that the judge himself recognized that the jury wasn't going to limit themselves to placing Mr. Walker's words in context. They were going to look at these wiretaps and determine that Mr. Cabell was the source of his cocaine. They were going to use it for a substantive purpose. And then it goes back to being hearsay again. If they're going to use it as a substantive purpose, I can't cross-examine Mr. Cabell. It's hearsay. So that in itself is grounds to reverse this case. Then we have the
And what are you saying that the court found that they were going to use it substantively and the court didn't address that? I thought the court let him in as admissions. His part, just like you said, was because these were statements he made. It showed how he was getting the dope. It showed his source of the dope.
His parts were admissions, but they were limited by the judge's instruction to show his state of mind.
Right, and to go to the issue of intent. And he instructed the jury to that effect, didn't he?
Yes. And but he told us in court, outside the presence of the jury, that the jury was going to conclude, if they determine that this is Mr. Walker's voice, they're going to conclude that Mr. Cabell is the source of his cocaine. And he said that that was probative. I don't think the judge himself believed that his limiting instruction was going to be effective. And it wasn't. The jury's not going to limit itself to that. I can't cry. And then it's hearsay. If it's not limited to that very specific limited purpose, then it's hearsay and I can't cross-examine it. Another real problem with that evidence is that it invited the jury to convict him of a conspiracy involving Mr. Cabell. The trial judge said, well, he's not a conspirator under the law of the Seventh Circuit. So I don't really agree with the law of the Seventh Circuit, but I will follow it. Mr. Cabell is not a conspirator. I said, well, judge, then instruct the jury to that effect. Tell them that he is not a conspirator, so they don't convict him of conspiracy involving Mr. Cabell. The evidence of the conspiracy with Rose McCray was very weak. There's only one delivery in the case that they can really point to on the evening of December the 6th, where she allegedly delivered drugs to Raymond Walker, or Raymond Walker delivered drugs to her, 5-6 grams. He's convicted of 50 grams. She said, he sold me cocaine over the months, but she was not a very believable person. The strong evidence in this case was the wiretaps. And I think the jury, in all likelihood, convicted him of a conspiracy involving Cabell. I said, judge, tell the jury he's not a conspirator. The government objected. The government didn't want to hear that. The government got exactly what it wanted, and I think it's reversible error.
Why wouldn't it be admissible under Rule 404?
Well, I've cited the cases there, Your Honor. It was admitted, Mr. Walker's statements were admitted to show his state of mind. Absence of mistake, that he wasn't a hapless fool incriminated by the government in some kind of a overzealous governmental activity, et cetera, and so on. But I didn't present any, and he didn't present any evidence that he didn't have the intent. His defense was simply lack of credibility of the government's witness. He didn't say that there was a mistake. He didn't say he was entrapped. He didn't say he had no intent. So why should they be able to introduce evidence of his intent? And that's what the cases I cited.
But let's say you have a conspiracy over here, and then you have a separate transaction over here, and government wants to use this second transaction unrelated to the conspiracy simply as other crimes evidence under 404B?
Well, of course, 404B says you can't do that. 404B prohibits that.
Well, no, it makes it admissible for certain purposes.
Except for limited purposes. In this case, the limited purpose was to show his intent, which was not an issue, and to show that he was not a hapless fool drug into something, which was not an issue. The government got to use this evidence basically to show that he had a propensity to commit cocaine crimes, and he had, in fact, discussed cocaine crimes. I don't think he got a fair trial because of that. I don't know why they wouldn't give a limiting instruction to tell the jury that you can't convict him of that crime. If you're going to convict him based upon what Rose McCray said, not upon this alleged connection with Mr. Cabell. I think there's a strong argument on the best evidence rule dealing with this buy money. The police gave buy money to Rose McCray, took down the serial numbers, made photocopies of it, gave it to her. Something happened between two houses on a dark night. She came out and she said, Raymond Walker sold me cocaine. They arrested Raymond Walker. They searched him. They found $2,450 in his possession. Officer Hornbrook, Trooper Hornbrook, wanted to say, I looked at those bills and they matched the serial numbers. I said, wait, where are the bills? The rule says when you want to prove the content of a writing, you got to have the writing. He said, well, I don't have the bills. Our policy with the Indiana State Police is to recirculate them. I said, well, why didn't you make a photocopy of them? And I asked the same question here today. That money was a critical piece of evidence. Without that money, without his testimony that those serial numbers matched, you're down to Rose McCray and something that happened out of sight of everyone, with tape recordings, which don't contribute much at all.
So in your argument, then, any time marked bills are used in a drug buy or money seized in a bank robbery or something like that, that would have to be held as evidence for however long the criminal proceedings and appellate proceedings would last in a case before it could be returned and put back into circulation.
If that's impractical, Your Honor, they can make photocopies of them. Which they made photocopies of the buy money before they turned it over to her. They could have made photocopies of the money that they recovered from Raymond Walker and then put the money back into circulation. They didn't do it. They just wanted to rely upon the officer's testimony to prove the contents of the writing. If the rule means anything, it says in that situation, the writing is required. The government didn't act reasonably in this case. And also, we ask Your Honor to consider the effect of Booker versus the United States and Apprendi on the sentencing aspect. I realize the law is against him at this point, but I think it may change in the future. The judge was the finder of fact under the statute on his enhancement of his two prior felony convictions. Not just the fact of the conviction, that they had convictions, but they are of a specific kind, a drug crime. Small fact, but it's a fact. And the United States Supreme Court says, if you're going to find facts to enhance a sentence, you have to have a jury. I realize Almendarez-Torres is an exception. Judge Justice Scalia has indicated that the court may reconsider that at a future time. We want to preserve that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Brimson. Mr. Brookman?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Matt Brookman. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Indiana. I'm in the Evansville office, and I'm here today to ask that you affirm the conviction set down by the jury in the case against Mr. Walker. A couple of points of clarification that I'd like to start out with. With regard to the wiretap phone calls and the transcripts, those phone calls were discovered in February of 2005. The case was indicted in January of 2005. The phone calls were discovered in February of 2005. They were immediately disclosed to Mr. Brinson, Mr. Walker's counsel. And the trial did not occur until August of 2005. So I think, as the court correctly pointed out, there was no surprise here. There was no prejudice whatsoever with regard to the phone calls. They didn't come in on the first day of trial. They had been in the defendant's possession for a long time. And I think it's somewhat disingenuous to say that I have these phone calls that show my client, the defendant, speaking to his cocaine source about receiving cocaine and turning it into crack cocaine, and he's now charged with a cocaine conspiracy, but to say that I didn't know if the government would intend to use those. If that were the case, then the same could be said with all the discovery in the case. He could say, I didn't know if you intended to use the controlled buys that you provided me reports on, or I didn't know if you intended to use the confidential informant that you provided me reports on. So there was no surprise in this case whatsoever. He was not prejudiced in any way by the admission of these phone calls and by the nature of the indictment in this case. The question as to the phone calls' admissibility as evidence at trial, as Mr. Brinson pointed out, the judge, Judge Young, did find that the phone calls, the Walker portion of the phone calls, were his verbal acts and admissions by the defendant. And as such, those portions of the phone call would come in, and the portion of Mr. Cabell's statements in the phone call would only be there to provide context, but would otherwise be hearsay. But here's the important point that I think to remember with regard to the nuts and bolts admissibility of the calls at trial. The court also found, alternatively, that these phone calls were, that the Cabell portion of the phone calls were adoptive admissions or adoptive statements that the defendant adopted. In other words, by negotiating, over and over on phone calls, drug transactions with Mr. Cabell, his source, the defendant, in effect, and as a matter of law, adopts what Mr. Cabell is saying also. And under that approach, the adoptive statements approach, and that is a recognized form of evidence in the Seventh Circuit, and under that approach, the Cabell portions of the phone calls were not hearsay at all. They're just direct evidence of the conspiracy. Judge Young found on both of those basis, and I think on either or, the phone calls were clearly admissible at trial, admissible evidence.
Well, isn't that part of why it was important for the court to instruct that Cabell was not a co-conspirator? I think that's something the defense wanted.
The defense wanted an instruction that Mr. Cabell, I think the exact wording.
I mean, given under either theory, I mean, you can see how a jury might get confused when they look at the conspiracy instruction. This comes in with Cabell, and I understand the court gave a limiting instruction when the calls were played, but doesn't that highlight why it was important to give such an instruction?
Well, a couple things about the jury instruction, Your Honor. Judge Young found very clearly that under Rivera, he did not believe that Mr. Cabell was a co-conspirator of Mr. Walker's. Nevertheless, my argument to the court, and I believe the court accepted this argument, was that even if he's not a co-conspirator, he's still some evidence of the crime that was charged. The instruction, the precise instruction, I think, that Mr. Brinson requested from the court stated that you are instructed that Emmanuel Cabell was not charged in this conspiracy with Raymond Walker. That's a statement of fact. It's really not a statement of law. It was a fact that he was not named in the conspiracy. Emmanuel Cabell was not named in the conspiracy with Mr. Walker. So I don't think it was a proper instruction because it really didn't instruct the jury on any law, and it just made a statement of fact. But more important than that,
yeah, but of course, courts do that all the time when it's stipulations or give judicial notice of certain facts. I mean, I just I'm a little puzzled why the government so resisted when, as you said, it was obvious, and if it would have just aided the jury in terms of making that conclusion. I understand he could argue it. I was just curious why that was resisted. So,
well, I think part of that is, as the counsel for the government, I try to bring my instructions in a week, 10 days before trial, and then frequently you get a handwritten instruction handed to you at the instruction conference, and there's some natural resistance to those all the time. I understand the court's the court's point at this time, and it may very well have been an okay instruction, but the fact of the matter is that Mr. Brinson was told on the record that he could make that argument to the jury, and in fact was told that the government agreed with that argument, and there'd be no argument counter to it that he was a member of the conspiracy. That was very clear. So, and I think that was done in closing argument as well.
Well, like you said, that was a weak reason for, you know, just because at the last minute their handwritten instructions. I mean, we were all trial judges. That's pretty typical of defense counsel. And now in this world of computers, it only takes a second to get something typed. So, you know,
I agree with that. I guess my biggest point on the spot at trial was that I felt like it was a statement of fact more than a statement of law, and I didn't want to inject instructions that were going to confuse rather than clarify points.
Can you go to this best evidence issue? Because a lot of these cases you cited, the government had a copy of the bills before they, you know, when they gave them to the CI, they had a copy. And then after a defendant was arrested or there was a search or whatever, there was another copy made of the bills that were retrieved from the defendant, and then you actually had that. I don't think there's any case you cited like our situation here where there was no paper on the other end.
I don't think there was a case like that either. The situation in this case was just as you described, Your Honor, that the bills were photographed prior to the buy. The money was given to the confidential informant. When the defendant was arrested, the money was seized from his pocket. The original bills were compared with the photograph copies, and the trooper concluded that they were the same bills. But I don't believe that this situation implicates the best evidence rule. In fact, my concern with admitting the photocopies was that perhaps would have implicated the best evidence rule, because then you are offering a document that is not the original. The important factor...
But then couldn't you have gotten it in his past recollection recorded? You know, because...
It was already past... Well, yes, I suppose, or mm-hmm. refreshed. But the fact of the matter was that he was refreshed by looking at the serial numbers from comparing the photocopies with the bills that he saw on that date. To me, what was important about it was that he never testified to what the serial numbers were or what the content of any of the bills were. He merely testified as a fact witness that I looked at these and compared them with what I had given him before, and they were the same.
Yeah, but the way he knew they were the same was because of the writings that were on the bills, right?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct.
But and it would have mattered.
It had no bearing whatsoever what those writings were. In other words, it could have been a gold coin that he said, I looked at this and saw that this is the same gold coin. It could have been a personal memento that he handed him and saw anything that was not fungible, you know, anything that could be looked at and observed that it was in fact the same item. It could have been any of those things. So it was totally irrelevant and not material whatsoever to the case what the content of the bills were, what the serial numbers in fact were. It didn't make any difference. The only thing that made a difference was that he observed both of them. He observed the bills before the buy. He observed the bills after the buy, and they were the same bills.
Well, it speaks to his credibility, too, doesn't it?
It does speak to his credibility. And the defense had an opportunity to cross-examine on that and test his credibility. And the defense, in fact, had the photocopy as well. So if they saw an irregularity or if there was any possible prejudice or any way to test his credibility on that, it would have been done, and it wasn't.
How many bills are we speaking about? Just in number. I don't mean denomination.
I believe it was somewhere in the neighborhood. I want to say anywhere from five to 15 bills.
Five to 15 bills. He's testifying on what date?
He's testifying on August, middle of August of 2005.
And he made the observation when?
The transaction occurred in December 6th of 2004,
seven months later. He's recalling an observation he made 8 months earlier.
That's correct. And he's recalling that observation, but he's also recalling what he observed from when he actually compared the bills would have been the same evening.
Right.
I'm just curious, do they make copies now after bills are retrieved from an individual?
They do at my request, yes, on case.
Uh,
One other point I'd like to clarify or respond to defense counsel's argument here, appellant's counsel, about the evidence of the conspiracy. He described it as very weak, and I think in that I would disagree with that strongly. I believe that the evidence of the conspiracy, even absent the wiretap phone calls, was very strong. Rose McCray testified, and I saw a different witness than Mr. Brenson saw. I thought she was a very strong witness. She testified. She had a compelling story. It was corroborated by the other evidence in the case.
Well, the main other evidence was, oh, of course, there was another buy.
There were other buys. And there were buys off of Rose McCray as well. There was a search warrant also that was conducted. Of course, this wasn't evidence of the trial because it was Judge Young suppressed the, a consent search that Judge Young suppressed prior to trial, but that also corroborated what she said.
Well, that didn't come into evidence, though, so that's irrelevant, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it corroborated what she was telling, for me anyways, but for the jury, the other buys together with the surveillance and the search warrant, the wiretap phone calls corroborated what Ms. McCray was saying completely, and I thought she was a very strong witness, not a weak witness. I don't have anything further at this time. If there are any other questions, I'll take those.
Of course, if the bills aren't admissible, then that certainly affects that particular buy.
Well,
the testimony relating to the bills hadn't been admitted.
It would. If the bills were not admitted, if the testimony regarding the bills was stricken out, what you'd be left with is Ms. McCray says that she conducted the transaction with the defendant. The surveillance up to the point where she went in the residence and after she came out of the residence, the defendant's arrest leaving the residence, just outside on the street of the residence, leaving immediately after the transaction. This all occurred in a very short time frame, too. So there was still abundant evidence of that transaction occurring. Count five, I believe it was.
And was she patted down when she came out of the residence?
Yes, she was, and she was patted down before she went in, and there was testimony from the law enforcement officer who conducted those searches as well at trial. Are there any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Brookman. Did you want to? Thank you, Mr. Brookman. Mr. Brenson.
The court advised me that I could argue to the jury that Mr. Cabell was not a member of this conspiracy. But the indictment itself says that the grand jury says that this conspiracy involved Rose McCray, a person named John Jordan, and other persons known and unknown to the grand jury. Now, I really don't know how I could have argued that he was not one of these persons known to the grand jury but not named. The only way to make that point is with the court's instruction, which was denied.
Brenson, did you submit a theory of the defense instruction?
I don't think I did, Your Honor.
Well, could you have done that and incorporated that he was not a conspirator with Mr. Cabell?
The instruction I submitted at final argument was consistent with the instruction I requested. When the evidence was offered, I asked for a limiting instruction exactly the same when the evidence was offered, and at the time of final instruction, it was. You are instructed that the defendant is not charged with being in a conspiracy with Emmanuel. That's all I wanted them to know.
The government didn't argue that Cabell was a co-conspirator.
No, they didn't. Well, they argued the wiretaps. They presented telephone calls.
But the government, in its argument, did not. I think you have a better case if the government argues, keep that instruction out, and then the government goes and argues that Cabell was a conspirator.
I haven't reviewed the final arguments lately. No.
Well, did you argue that he wasn't a conspirator? And so to get back to Judge Flom's point, you know, in terms of a theory of defense, you're always entitled to a theory of defense instruction. So this could have been encompassed in that.
I took the approach I took.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Brenson. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Court will proceed to the second.